parents learn exactly what they need to do, exactly what they need to be willing to give up in order to see their kids achieve the dreams that they have for them. And so parents begin to put money away for college 18 years in advance. Parents will drive their kids to practice after practice or rehearsal after rehearsal or activity after activity to help push their kid toward that dream. 18 years early, parents are making decisions about the kind of preschool that will prepare their kid for the right college. Parents will sometimes spend a fortune to move, buying a new house in a certain neighborhood to give their kid opportunities that they need for the best education or the best athletic programs. Parents count the cost of getting their kids to these goals. And parents are ready and they are willing to say no to everything along the way that stands in the way of achieving those goals. Parents will sacrifice their children's childhood for the sake of making them into certain kinds of adults. This is exactly what Jesus is talking about. This is exactly what Jesus is demanding when he says, any one of you who does not renounce all that he or she has cannot be my disciple. Just as a college coach tells the student that their team, that this team that you want to play for just doesn't have room for two sport athletes. Jesus tells his followers that he just doesn't have room for followers who have two masters. This sounds really extreme. In fact, this is one of those passages in Scripture that people really struggle with or completely ignore. It can go both ways. See, I think that there is a problem with the way that we encourage people to know Jesus, that encourages people to ignore passages like this. We teach people that you need to believe an idea about Jesus, that you need to believe in an event, the death and the resurrection of Jesus, and we tell people to simply believe and they'll be saved. But of course, when Paul says in Romans that you need to believe this truth in your heart, he also says you need to confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord. And so you need to live as though Jesus is Lord. And if Jesus is Lord, then you will have submitted your life to his authority. And if Jesus is Lord, then you will desire to do his will. And if Jesus is Lord, you are committed to obeying him and being discipled by him. If Jesus is Lord, you come when he invites you. And this is what our passage this morning is about. It's about an invitation. Right? We heard it in the passages that were read. We hear Jesus tell a story about people invited to a banquet. In chapter 14, verse 16, a man says, blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. And so Jesus responds, a man once gave a great banquet and invited many, and at the time for the banquet, he sent his servant to say to those who had already been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, I bought a field and I must go out and see it. Please have me excused. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I go to examine them. Please have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife and therefore I cannot come. So the servant came and reported these things to the master. Then the master of the house became angry. Can you hear what's happening here? A man invites people to come and enjoy his presence. A man invites people to come and enjoy his generosity and to be fed and to be filled at his table. And the people who have already been invited, who knew this was coming, have now heard the announcement. The time is here. The banquet is beginning. And they aren't ready to show up for it. They're distracted. They're busy. They can't be bothered to show up. Now, none of these people is living lives of sin, right? They're being good, what we would call responsible adults. They're taking care of business. One man is examining the oxen that he's just purchased for the family business. Another man is being a good steward of his assets, examining some new land that he's purchased for his family. Another man has made his new wife a priority, turning down the invitation in order to spend time with her. Like, these are good things. But when Jesus is Lord, they can never be ultimate things. And the banquet invitation is about a final decision that actually reflects smaller decisions made up to that point, right? So that if you have not been anticipating the announcement that the dinner is ready, you may be taken off guard when it finally comes. Most of you have heard what Jane and I do when I'm in the middle of a conversation and she is ready to leave. She gives me a time warning, like I'm a child, but this is something that works for us and I've agreed to submit to this. She's ready to leave and she needs me to be ready to leave as well, but I need some time to prepare for that. And so she warns me and I prepare to end the conversation. If she comes back at the end of the time and I'm not ready to respond, and I'm not ready, and I respond poorly, that's on me. I knew better. This is a long-running arrangement that we have. Each day, when Jesus calls you to come and to enjoy friendship with him, when his Spirit draws you to come and to hear his word in the scriptures, when he invites you each day to come and to respond to him in prayer, to come and to be present with him, do you respond to the invitation? Are you expecting it? Or are you too busy with the stuff that you have going on? Important stuff, good stuff, responsible adult stuff, parental stuff, future security stuff, good stuff. How you respond daily says a lot about how you will respond when that final invitation comes to join Jesus at his banquet. It's interesting that like through the years, I have personally found the mornings to be the easiest time for me to spend with Jesus. I wake up and I haven't opened my email yet and I haven't looked at my to-do list or my calendar, and there's a sort of like blankness or emptiness to my brain. And so I found it much easier to seek him in the morning. But the question of my loyalty, the question of whether Jesus is my only Lord, the question of my responsiveness to his word and his Spirit is actually better tested during the day. Or for me, even as the day ends, because once I'm in the midst of my work and family and schedules and friendships and priorities and entertainment, while all of this is pressing on me from all directions and consuming my attention, when I hear Jesus in the midst of all that, inviting me to stop and to be present with him, will I? Can I? Or will I respond, not right now, Jesus. I've got some important things to attend to. I'm in like episode 3 of this like 9-episode binge. I'm a little distracted. Later, when I have some time, maybe tomorrow morning, that's the perfect time for me. Can you hear the difference? On one hand, I have found a place in my schedule to meet with Jesus consistently. On the other hand, there is this real question as to whether the rest of my schedule is available for Jesus to interrupt. There's a real question as to whether Jesus is my only Lord, or just one of a series of Lords that includes my job and my family and my entertainment? Is Jesus the manager of my life and my schedule, or is he like a hobby or an extracurricular activity, an event to fit into my schedule to help fill my life so my life is fuller and richer? And so the definitive question here is, with who or what am I responsive to? Right? I mean, the college student that I referred to earlier who dreams of being a professional athlete is responsive to that dream. They're responsive to a coach. They're responsive to intense discipline that will cost him or her everything else in order for the chance to attain that end goal. The parent who dreams of their kid going to the best college so that their kid can get a prestigious, high-paying job is responsive to that dream. It's responsive to a disciplined life that will cost everything else. Jane and I recently had to start talking about the dreams that we have for our kids. Becca has said that she never wants to get married or she never wants to have kids. Now, she's 8. So a million things could happen in the next 15 years to change her mind. There are certainly some suitable bachelors who are, you know, in children's church with her right now. But for Jane, getting married and having kids was a huge part of her dreams as a young girl growing up. And so to hear her daughter say that is difficult, right? Becca has also been telling us that when she grows up, she wants to be a house cleaner. Now, Jane and I both have master's degrees. We both believe in the importance of getting a college education. We both have worked hard to convince her that she can be anything when she grows up and to help her think that college is important and to work hard and to learn. But it's really interesting how telling our girls that they can be anything has mostly meant big stuff, right? Like, she could be president of the United States. She could be a scientist. She could be an astronaut. She could be a doctor. And yet for a couple years now, Beck has been saying in everywhere and every chance she gets that her hobbies are helping, cleaning, and organizing. She legitimately enjoys cleaning, and if you ask her, she'll tell you that she's really good at it. That's debatable, but we encourage her. And except for the fact, honestly, right, that house cleaners don't necessarily make much money, it's totally respectable work. It's work that you do with your hands. It's work that you can be proud of. It's work that you can do unto the Lord. But here Jane and I are bound by unique social barriers, right? By an imagination that says that our girls will grow into women of value, of virtue, if they grow up and do something worthy. If they go to college, if they get a good job, if they have a family, if they move out of the house. Jane and I are being called by society. We are being asked to respond to societal values. We are being invited to be part of the world around us by raising girls who provide something our culture sees as valuable, who can do what society values. House cleaning, not so valuable. Do you know how I know that? Because I've watched person after person question Beck and push her to consider something else, something better, something bigger, something more valuable to society. She's stubborn though. In fact, when you let your kid live as a disciple of Jesus, there are many people around you who are going to accuse you of hating your children, right? You must hate your children. You certainly don't want the best for them if you let them settle. You wouldn't let your child that you love settle for a quiet, holy life as a house cleaner, when they could be so much more? So Jane and I are wrestling and praying and talking. Who are we going to respond to? Who is Lord of our lives? Is it Jesus that is the Lord? Are we going to respond to his call to make disciples of our daughters? Or is society our Lord? Will we respond to society's call to make daughters who society finds valuable and worthy? The answer to this question can be super messy and it can be really confusing, right? Because there's actually this weird overlap between these lords, right? Because if we think about our society broadly, our society actually still values people who have a moral compass. Broadly, famous stars and famous athletes publicly thank God for their achievements, which means that you can actually choose society as Lord. You can make kids who are valuable to society, and they can still keep going to church and talking about Jesus. It is possible to produce kids who live for status and honor and wealth and fame and the stuff of our culture while hanging on to Jesus as an accessory or a good luck charm or a moral standard or fire insurance or a backup plan. He can be a lot of different things. To a person without being Lord. This is why Jesus says, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Man, doesn't this seem harsh? Except, I mean, is it really? I mean, because it makes a lot of sense. In every other area of our lives, we expect devotion and discipline. If someone intends to develop and grow and become an expert at something. And so why shouldn't it require some amount of devotion and discipline to become more like Jesus? Paul seems to think, as we read his letters, that devotion and discipline are pretty essential. Certainly, devotion and discipline are grounded, rooted in love, but we can't neglect them. In our passage this morning, a bit earlier than what we read, chapter 13, verse 22, we read that Jesus went on his way through towns and villages, and he was teaching and he was journeying. And someone said to him, Lord, will those who are saved be few? And he said to them, strive to enter through the narrow door, for many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able. When once the master of the house has risen and shut the door and you begin to stand outside and knock at the door saying, Lord, open to us, then he will answer, I do not know you. I do not know where you come from. Then you will begin to say, but we ate and we drank in your presence and you taught in our streets. But he will say, I tell you, I do not know where you come from. Depart from me, all you workers of evil. This sounds a lot like that passage that we know of where Jesus says, you say to me, Lord, Lord, but I say to you, I never knew you. Right here, Jesus claims a pretty incredible claim that those who have a seat in his presence, those who have sat in the presence of Jesus, they have experienced his touch. They will have seen his power. They will have tasted his generosity. They will have heard his words. And yet, these people do not trust Jesus as their Lord. They continue to serve other lords. The American church has spent an incredible amount of money and time and resources creating experiences for kids and teenagers and adults where they can experience the presence of Jesus, eating and drinking with him, hearing his teaching. But the American church is not willing far too often to pay the cost of being a disciple of Jesus. American Christians want Jesus and their stuff too. American Christians want Jesus and their entertainment too. American Christians want Jesus, but they also want to be upwardly mobile. American Christians want to be safe and secure and normal. and valuable. And American Christians want their kids to be saved. And yet the overwhelming majority of American Christians don't describe themselves as the primary discipler of their children or the kids in their church. They want the church to offer programs that help their kids like the church and help their kids be nicer and be well-adjusted. But because American Christians refuse to stop identifying as American, Christian can never be more than like an add-on, right? We're Americans, but we also go to church. We're Christians, but our lives look just like all of our neighbors. And so Jesus asks us, what good is salt if it has lost its saltiness? Shouldn't you taste differently? If I were going to summarize our whole passage this morning, it would be this way. Jesus says, you must come to me with nothing. It's interesting. Who tends to be offended by that statement? Two groups of people, typically, both with something, right? The first group being pagans of the world with stuff or hopes for stuff, right? Who find something about Jesus attractive. Maybe it's his power, maybe it's his miracles, maybe it's that other people are drawn to him, whatever it is, they find themselves attracted to him. And so they come around to check Jesus out, and then they hear him begin to talk like this, and they hear him say, renounce everything, hate your father and your mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters. And because they love their stuff and because they value their family above all else, they walk away sad, for they put great value on the things that they have. There's a second group of people who get offended by Jesus. And this group are Christians who, having come to, not all Christians, but a particular group of them, having come to Jesus, having entrusted their lives to Jesus, they've never really given up their idea of an upwardly mobile life. Maybe they've been exposed to the prosperity gospel a bit too many times. But however it happened, having started with nothing, having come to Jesus with nothing, with no family or kids or real possessions or status, these Christians have, for whatever reason, begun to move up in society. They move from an apartment to a house. They've started a family. They've begun to put away some savings. They have let themselves believe that this movement upward is God's plan for them, that this is God's desire, and that this is God blessing them. And so they start to read the pages of Luke and they get really uncomfortable. And Christians reading this, who love what they have, do one of two things. They take offense at Jesus, or they just ignore what they're reading. They don't have ears to hear that their lives no longer taste like salt. That they just taste like everyone else. They don't have ears to hear that they are trusting another Master. It's interesting to recognize that not everyone is offended when they hear Jesus talk like this, which is great news, right? Hey, okay, we don't have to be offended. This is cool. So do you know who isn't fazed even the slightest, even a little bit, when Jesus talks like this? It's the poor and the crippled and the blind and the lame. Jesus instructs a man to invite these sorts of guests to dinner. Do you know why? Because they will always come. They will always come empty-handed. They will have nothing to offer the host, and they will have nothing that will keep them from coming. You invite them to eat a meal and they will be there. So Jesus then tells this man, not only to invite these sorts of guests, but he then tells this parable to sort of explain it all. And it's the same parable we heard earlier, but we're going to hear the end of it. After the guests who were invited by the master have turned the master down, you know, because they were busy doing respectable adult stuff, taking care of the things that they have accumulated. The master gives instructions to his servant. And so chapter 14, beginning in verse 21, we hear the master say, "Now go out quickly to the streets and the lanes of the city and bring in the poor and crippled and blind and lame." These are the same people that he had just told the master, the host earlier to bring in. "Bring them in. Bring in the poor, crippled, blind, and lame." And the servant said, "Sir, what you commanded has been done, and there's still room." So the master said to the servant, "Go out to the highways and the hedges and compel people to come in, that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of these men who were invited shall taste my banquet." And this is incredible, right? Who is invited to this banquet? By the time we're done with it, everybody. There were those who were initially invited. There was a second round of invites. And then there was like there's plenty of more room. Let's bring everybody else in. Everyone is invited. There is more than enough room. The master is eager to share what he has with as many people as he can. When Jesus tells parables like this, we are to see the heart of the generous Father, our God in heaven, who is not willing that any should perish, but is eager to bring all to his table. But the only people excluded at the end of this story, the only people excluded are those who have stuff, land and oxen and wives. Because having stuff, they were incapable of hearing and responding to the call of the master. And so they were excluded from the banquet. Not by the master. The master invited them, but by themselves and by their own divided loyalties. But do you recognize who comes? Who responds to this invitation? Do you know who has nothing standing in the way, nothing to distract them, nothing to keep them busy? It's those with nothing. The poor, the blind, the crippled, and the lame. These are ancient categories that work together to summarize an entire group of people, a group that are marginalized, a group that has nothing. And this is remarkable. Those with nothing are invited to come to Jesus with nothing. And those with everything are also invited to come to Jesus with nothing. Everyone is invited on the same terms. So for those who have everything or have much and think that it's somehow not fair that they should have to give everything, to renounce everything, you just get to come on the same terms as everybody else. And it shouldn't surprise us that when the church has been faithful throughout history, through the last 2,000 years, its message has often appealed first to those with nothing. And those with everything have often been offended, or at least really uncomfortable. There's some great writing in the early church, where we find out that those in the early church who had much found clever and creative ways to avoid the gatherings of the church because they often felt uncomfortable by how much they had in relation to others. It's not enough to eat and drink with Jesus. But we must be satisfied by Jesus. It's not enough to hear Jesus' teaching. We must submit to it. Jesus is once again calling us to his table. Eat and drink and be satisfied in me alone, Jesus says, and do this in remembrance of me. And it's not enough to walk away from this table then saying, I ate and drank in his presence I heard his teaching this morning. It was great. No. Will you leave the table, not simply eating and drinking, but continuing to find your life and your satisfaction in Jesus alone? Will you leave the table this morning, not having merely heard his words, but living them, doing them, obeying them? Jesus invites you this morning to come and renounce everything so that he can give you everything you need to be his disciple. This is his gracious invitation to be with him and walk with him.